Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, retired. He was with the Special Forces, served in Vietnam, but before he went to Vietnam, he was trained at an assassin school. Now, to the average American, the idea that they would train people in the Special Forces to be assassins seems very, very odd. Why would we want to train anybody to be assassins? Well, the reason you train people to be assassins is so they can kill people. And the reason you use the Special Forces is because we don't want the CIA doing that sort of thing, so we get the Special Forces to do it, or sometimes they get the Mafia to do it, or they train all sorts of people to be assassins. And if you don't think that they use assassinations on political opponents or on people who speak out and tell the truth, you really don't understand what goes on in the world today. Those of you who've heard our interviews with the survivors of the attack on the USS Liberty, it was an American intelligence gathering ship that was sent over just off the coast of the Sinai in 1967, during the 67 war. The plan was that the ship was going to be sunk. They got the Israelis to strafe the ship, to bomb the ship, the torpedoes, boats to come and try to torpedo the boat. Special Forces units were going to be landed on the boat to kill the remaining survivors, and everybody was to die so that we could justify going to war with Egypt. But it didn't work out, and tragically. But what was so interesting, talking to the survivors, they were told that if they ever told the truth, why, they would be sent to Leavenworth for an indefinite period of time or worse. And they knew what "or worse" was. That meant they'd be killed. We have the interviews with many of the survivors. The story is there. You'll never hear it in America. But I think it's important for people to understand the world as it really is, not as we wish it were, and has nothing to do with our government. It is the fact that there is an invisible government that is inherently evil, and unfortunately, these people are in working control of our nation today, and we need to take it back. But I wanted Colonel Marvin to come forward and tell you, because most people in the Special Forces will not talk about this for fear of their lives. Fortunately, Colonel Marvin knows the Lord and has put his future in the Lord's hands, and so far he's sustained him. Colonel, thank you so very much for being with us.
Amen. It's a blessing always to be on your show, Dr. Stan, because you only let the truth come out on your show, and it's so much needed in the United States of America and in the whole world, really. This whole thing on assassination kind of reminds me of the statement from Colonel George White, who is a former OSS officer and who went to work for the CIA when it first began, really. And when he retired in the mid-60s, he wrote a letter to his friend, and he said this, and I'll quote him, "I toiled wholeheartedly in the vineyards because it was fun, fun, fun. Where else, speaking of the CIA, could a red-blooded American boy lie, kill, cheat, steal, rape, and pillage with the blessing of the All Highest?" And I was one of those trained to do just that at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, about 3 months after President Kennedy was killed by our government.
And, of course, you heard the CIA agents actually talking about that. In fact, didn't they tell you that Kennedy was killed because he was working against the best interests of our country?
Well, basically, what they told us was that there was 4 Mafia people involved as hitmen, 2 from the U.S. Mafia, one of which I happen to know personally. And one of them was on the grassy knoll, and the other one was on the rooftop next to the book depository. The other two...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Right.
Colonel, go right ahead.
Okay. The other one was on the rooftop next to the book depository, and the two Corsican Mafia people were on the two routes leading to the hospital from where the hit was to be made at the Daily Plaza. And their job was, with a spotter, determine whether or not Kennedy would make it. And if they thought he would, they'd shoot him again on the way to the hospital. And during one of the breaks, one of the CIA instructors said to the other, and I overheard him personally, and so did one other Green Beret officer, said that things did go pretty well in Dallas, didn't they? So, I mean, I had no doubt in my mind that one of them had been a part of that whole operation to kill our president. You know, it's really interesting that Dr. Martin Luther King, who happens to be a real hero of mine, a man who will lead unarmed people against armed people for a cause, he was a very brave man. And the whole setup to kill him was accomplished by our own government. William Pepper has two books out about the Martin Luther King assassination, and he represented the King family in a trial in Memphis, Tennessee, where he proved, and I've got a copy of the findings of the jury and the judge's notes on it, he found our government 70% complicit in the murder of Dr. King.
How long was that trial, do you recall?
It was a week.
It was a week-long trial?
Week-long trial, and Jim Douglas, I hope that you can get him on your program someday, he was there for the whole trial, and only one other person was there for most of it, and it wasn't from the national news media. If I remember right, he told me that there were representatives of the national media there the first day, the first hours of the trial, and they were called out or went out one by one until there was none left that day, and they didn't come back.
All right, I always thought the trial was longer, but it was only 1 week. Anyway, we actually have an interview.
Well, I'm not sure of that.
Anyway, we have an interview with Mr. Rogers. We have actually four interviews we put together into a four-tape set. And we call it The Execution of Martin Luther King, and it's interviews with Mr. William Pepper and your friend Mr. Rogers and one other person, going into the background of how they killed Martin Luther King, and the jury found them, the government, guilty, and totally blacked out by the controlled media here in the United States. Hold on just a minute. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Marvin was simply talking about Sonny when he was in training. He was training at assassin school, and it was about 3 months after President Kennedy had been killed, and they told him exactly where all the shooters were, and of course, who was, they didn't give the names of the shooters, but they where the various shooters were stationed, so they knew, of course, it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone gunman, the lie that they tried to get the American people to actually accept, and of course, actually, Hale Boggs was on that committee, the Warren Commission. Hale Boggs was a congressman from the South, and he never did believe that until the day he died. And, of course, the day he died was after his plane went down in Alaska with of course, Nick Begich's dad on it. Congressman Boggs was helping Nick Begich's father running for Congress. The plane went down. The FBI knew where the plane was and made sure that there would never be any help to go out there. And Hale Boggs, who was a member of the Warren Commission, who did not believe in the Warren Commission, conclusions, was allowed to die with everybody on the small plane. They survived the landing, but they died of starvation and exposure, thanks to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which simply, like so many people, carries out orders, and if you get an order and you don't obey it, you're through. In fact, you could very well be sent to prison. Well, anyway, Colonel, they trained you there to be an assassin. What sort of training did you actually have?
Let me go back to the fact that it was Jim Douglas who was my friend who was at
Jim
the
Douglas,
trial.
Okay. Well, whoever your friend got him, I actually interviewed him, and he's part of our four-tape set.
Wonderful.
On the on Martin Luther King and, of course, how he was killed because he was becoming an embarrassment to the government. He wanted to get out of Vietnam, and they didn't want to get out of Vietnam. They wanted to keep our boys going over there fighting a no-win war and fighting and bleeding and suffering and dying, but never, never, never be allowed to win. So
Dr.
go ahead.
Stan, I'll tell you, you and your program do so much for this United States of America with regard to telling the truth. I know you you sell the book Without Smoking Gun.
Right.
And in that book, excuse me, people should buy that book, because in that it even tells of another person, Colonel Bo Greitz, who admits not only that assassination training was taking place at Fort Bragg about the same time that I went through, but that he was one of the trainers of enlisted men in assassination training. Assassination training really consisted of a lot of different things, but the primary effort was to determine who it was that could actually take the burden of volunteering to commit murder for our government, for the flag. It was a lot of mind control going on there to convince us, as they did me at the time until I got saved, to convince us that anybody that we were asked to kill, and you were always asked, you couldn't be ordered, because they had to cut off any thing that would tie us in, or the killing in with the government, that you would go ahead and do it and then not tell anybody about it, basically, if you made it back from the mission. And a lot of them were suicide-type missions. But one of the things that we did, too, was learn terror techniques in that same training, to include torture. In my particular class, there were majors and lieutenant colonels. I was a captain. Not a one of the majors or lieutenant colonels made it through that special forces course. Number one, they didn't want to be assassins. Number two, they refused to allow another member of the class, like myself, to torture them with electricity. It was just a way that we could learn what an effect torturing had on the individual that's being questioned. It's one of the many things they don't advertise. This is all special training by CIA instructors in a special building with concertina wire all around it and guard dogs. And believe it or not, Dr. Stan, and I'm sure you do believe it, out of 10,000 Green Berets, active and retired, there's only one that I know of that's willing to go with me before Congress and tell them about the training that Green Berets go through, some of the jobs they have. In fact, he was on the same team that I first commanded, which was a portable atomic bomb team. And he's willing to come forward. He lives just 20 miles from me in Syracuse, New York. But none others are willing to come forward.
Well, don't you think they're probably afraid to come forward for fear of the reprisals against them?
Oh, that's it. You know darn well when you go through the training that though you are being trained as an assassin. And then if you go and you're used just really to silence people more than anything else, that you'll be the one to be silenced. That, you know, I put right in my book, I did not start this book, Expendable Elite, until the day I got saved. Because I no longer, once I feared the Lord, and I had faith in the Lord's ability to protect me, that was the day that I started this book. Because before that, I was afraid they'd send somebody just like me to kill me.
And, of course, it's terrible to live in fear. Talking to the men who were on the USS Liberty, the sailors, who survived the attack that was supervised and certainly condoned by the people in Washington, D.C., specifically Robert Strange McNamara, the Secretary of Defense at that time, and Lyndon Baines Johnson. These were evil people. Certainly Robert Strange McNamara, at least according to an article that appeared in West Magazine that we have, Robert Strange McNamara and Henry Kissinger regularly went and visited the occult center at La Boca Grande, which is in Colorado, set up by Marie Strong, where Satanists and witches and people from the dark side gather on a regular basis. And there's Robert Strange and McNamara going to that. Well, he was, of course, instrumental, of course, in the attack on the Liberty. And then, of course, the men, I mean, there were 280 men on board. There were 170 were wounded, I think 35 killed. But, of course, all of the men who survived were told they would be, in essence, killed if they ever came forward, and that was a real deterrent. It took 20 years before any of them had the courage to come forward and tell the truth. Of course, by that time, the media was totally controlled. The story has never been put out on the History Channel or the Discovery Channel. We do have an excellent DVD. It was actually put out by the British called, going into the background, it's called Dead in the Water, and then we have an excellent video on that, and we have a four-tape set and other material on the USS Liberty. But fear silenced every one of those men for a period of 20 years, and finally a few of them came forward, and then others came forward, and the story's gotten out, but you're never going to hear it through the regular channels.
No, even when you write it, like I did in my book, it took 13 years going to 102 publishers that all refused to publish my book because of the CIA involvement and their fear of the CIA. It wasn't until Chris Milligan called me. Now, there's a brave publisher, and he's the one that published my book and is standing by to publish any other book that I write that tells about the evil in government. He is a courageous man. But the media, I've tried to get on the Diane Rehm show. I've tried to get on all of the different network talk programs, but they won't they won't have me because they're afraid to.
And, of course, this is how you control access to information in America. In fact, as a result of writing that book, Expendable Elite, which incidentally we do carry and we do offer here through Radio Liberty, why, of course, both Chris Milligan and Colonel were sued. They threatened all the people on his Special Forces team, and, of course, they appeared then. They brought suit against him for libel for what he'd written in the book. Fortunately, he was able to put up a good defense, and although it cost a tremendous amount of money, the whole idea was to bankrupt them, to either frighten them into pulling the book or bankrupt them or punish them for daring to tell the truth. But you and Chris won the trial, didn't you?
We sure did. They had actually, before the trial, they had threatened, in writing, Chris Milligan and his publishing company, and he didn't even bother to respond to him. I responded to him in writing because he's my friend and he's a man of truth. And then they took us to trial and they tried to get us not to go to trial. In fact, it was interesting. When we got there, before the trial started, the very first day, we were all in the courtroom, and I overheard their senior counsel tell the other counsel, which was his son, one of the other two attorneys, and this counsel had been, Deaver was his name, had been a counsel for Special Forces for 20-some years. He looked at his son and said, you know, I didn't think Marvin would show up. Well, I heard him. And I walked over to their side of the court, and I put my nose about a half an inch from his, and I told him, you know, the thing that you forgot is that I used to be one of you, and I was the biggest, baddest one of you, and I'm telling the truth. But that they operate through fear, no doubt about it.
And, of course, we're talking about things that are happening in the United States, ladies and gentlemen. We need to take our country back from the wicked people who, of course, there's only a few of them, but they're very, very powerful. They're very, very wealthy. They work through the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, and other occult organizations tied into the dark side. And there really is a supernatural element that has given the power and the wealth that they have. But, of course, Like Colonel Marvin, we have to realize we have God on our side. And if we had the courage to stand up against them, like vampires, they would flee. The first rays of dawn, the first light is shining upon them, and they backed off. They're not going after Colonel Marvin anymore. They lost in court, and, well, they're leaving him alone, at least for the time being, although they threatened him and his family and his grandchildren. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, we're dealing with very nasty and wicked and evil people. Well, Colonel, certainly it's an amazing story, but I'm just so glad that the trial turned out as well as it did. And,
oh, it's beautiful.
Have you ever...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
him shortly before he died, and Westmoreland said his greatest regret that was, he never was allowed to win the war. Of course, he was just following orders. He should have had the courage to resign and come home and tell the American people, but if he'd tried, he never would have gotten a word out, and unfortunately, he betrayed his soldiers because he didn't want to give up power.
We need more General MacArthurs. You know, General Westmoreland did at least have the courage after he retired when he had no control at all. In his book, A Soldier Reports, as you know, I quote him in my book as saying flat out that he was ordered not to tell the American Congress nor any reporters that our president had given the enemy safe havens all along the Cambodian border, had given the enemy the right to use the Mekong River, and we protected their ships of international registration going up the Mekong River carrying weapons and ammunition for them to kill our men with.
And of course, it's exactly the same thing that's going on in Afghanistan today. We finance the Pakistani government. The Pakistani finances their military intelligence, the ISI. The ISI funds the Taliban, and the Taliban kill American soldiers in Afghanistan. And people can't figure out why we can't win the war. Because the Taliban are also funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia. Good friends, very good friends of the Bush family. Once you understand that Afghanistan is Vietnam all over again, it's a military exercise, and we're sending our boys in there to be slaughtered, and now President Obama is going to increase, probably double the number of men who will be going in there, and double the number of people who die. And, of course, you have to understand that our current administration is controlled by the same people who controlled the last administration. It is not simply by accident that there are 11 members of the Trilateral Commission. There are only 87 Americans who are members of the North American group of the Trilateral Commission. And 11 of them are serving in the government today. 5 of them are serving in the U.S. State Department, setting our policy and, of course, sending our boys off to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but never to win. We're in it. They know exactly what we're doing, but it's a wonderful diversion so the American people cannot effectively see what's going on. Well, Colonel, looking back on Vietnam and the tragedy there, and our men fought well and they fought bravely, but they, most of them didn't understand we never went there to win. Do you think that
is correct? Let's face it, my camp was the only one in all of Vietnam that was, at the time, was authorized to fire back at the enemy inside of Cambodia. You know, as I flew in, when I first arrived there in 1965, flew over to a camp called Vinh Gia, and when I got to Chau Dak, the B-team headquarters, one of the men there told me about the captain that had commanded the Special Forces camp in Vinh Gia had actually fired across the border at the enemy after they killed 5 of his men, and he was actually sent to prison in Leavenworth for shooting back at the enemy that had killed 5 of his people. That's the kind of government that we had running that war to make certain that they would win and not that we would.
I had a friend who flew F-4s there, and they would send a whole squadron up there, each with bombs, each one carrying about a third of a bomb load. Now, they could have sent one plane with a full bomb load if they wanted to do anything, but it was all make-believe. It was showbiz, and so they'd send three or four planes. I've forgotten how many in a squadron, but each one would carry, a third of a load of bombs, and then they would bomb a bridge, a little bridge over a little river, and then the next day it'd be rebuilt again, and then they go back again. And our boys, of course, were not allowed to shoot on the at the planes that were on the ground, the North Korean planes, pardon me, the North Vietnamese planes, the only time they could shoot at them if they were actually in the air. They weren't allowed to attack any of the anti-aircraft batteries unless they were actually firing at them. And, of course, because the planes were coming in from Russia, and we were funding Russia at the time, giving them massive amounts of equipment and money, and if we were even building the road into Afghanistan that we would, that the Soviets would use. Then, a decade later, to bring their forces into Afghanistan to begin the Afghan War. So it was all make-believe, but we couldn't let the American people know that. And, of course, they had the pro-war group, they had the anti-war group, and they were all controlled by the same people. And, of course, they're doing exactly the same thing throughout the world today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Colonel Dan Marvin. And Colonel, certainly, but you were in touch with this one man who had been such a good friend of yours, and he really couldn't defend what he'd done at all. I'm sure he must have felt very bad, and yet he did not have the courage as he'd grown older to take a stand. When he was told to do something, he did it, even though morally he knew it was wrong and he was betraying his best friend.
Even since the trial, Dr. Stan, I've been in touch with him twice, in writing and by telephone. He has bought two of my new books about our victory in court. But he refuses to sit down and write a letter to me so I'd have it as evidence showing that he was intimidated into signing that paper.
No, I haven't seen your new book. Is it out in print yet?
Oh, this is the Expendable Elite.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, fine.
The Victory Edition.
All right, fine.
Right, you have that.
Right, we do have that. No, I'm sorry.
And that's the one we were talking about, and he thought it was a good book. And, in fact, he sent it to his brother to read with a... He said, and I insisted on him sending it back to me because I want to keep it. It's a treasure. And here's one of the guys that was a plaintiff. One of the plaintiffs on that trial. You know, the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, Mr. Deaver, asked me a question in front of the jury. He said, is it true that you wrote that book hoping that the CIA would sue you? And I said, that is correct, sir. And he said, why? And I just looked the jury in the eyes. And I told him, I said, the only two things that the CIA could sue me for, one would be for publishing top secret information. And I said, it's very clearly identified in the book in all caps, just like we do top secret. And then the second thing they could sue me for, and this would be, I would have to go to prison for certain, would be that of giving Agent Walter McKim's full name, his real name, as a man who came to me and asked me if I would kill the leader of another country, Prince Norodom Sihanouk. And I turned away from the jury to my attorneys, and then I turned back to the jury, and I said I was willing to spend 3 or 4 years in prison just to get them to tell the truth to the American people. But that's the thing we're running up against.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. And we're really talking about his trial, but we're talking about the fact that as a trained assassin, he was asked by the CIA to kill the leader of a foreign nation. That would be Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia. Would you like to tell our listeners about the fact that you were asked as an American military officer to kill the leader of a foreign nation? Of course, they knew you were a trained assassin. You'd been trained in assassination. And, of course, unfortunately, they train our special forces troops. They're the elite. to do these terrible and wicked deeds, and yet, of course, they believe they're doing them in the name of patriotism. The flag, they don't understand that the people who are in charge have no loyalty to America. In fact, they want to destroy America. They want to create a world government. And, of course, they want, they're in the process now of destroying the infrastructure of our nation economically, destroying our currency, and, of course, destroying our Constitution. And yet people are in key positions. But tell our listeners about the fact that they asked if you would. They did not order you to, but they asked if you would kill Prince Siena.
Special Agent Walter McKim, and the whole story is in my book, Expendable Elite, for the folks that are listening. He came to my camp in June of 1966, and he asked me if I would mount up an operation of 100% South Vietnamese to go into Cambodia. And this particular time of the year, Prince Sihanouk went to visit a temple up northwest of his capital, and it took a certain route and everything else, and they gave us a map. He gave us a map showing where best ambush sites were. And what he wanted me to do was to organize and train them and equip them to look like communist forces, so they could blame the communists on his death. And they picked us because the Wahaos that I had, Buddhist Wahaos, were probably the best Vietnamese fighters in all of Vietnam. I had experience in what they were asking me to do, to train those people. And we got out of my 400 people that were in my camp, I got over 100 volunteers to go on that mission. 42 of them I selected, and then my men started training them. But I gave Agent McKim a quid pro quo. I said that President Johnson has got to tell the American people that he is stopping all sanctuaries for the Viet Cong and is going to stop letting them use the Mekong River for a supply route. And I've got a man standing by in Fort Bragg waiting for the New York Times to come out. At that time, we trusted it, and tell them that President Johnson had told the American people that, and then he'd also heard it on the radio, then we would go ahead with the operation. Well, he came back about 2 days before we were supposed to go across the border into Cambodia. We had stolen a barge that belonged to somebody in North Vietnam. We're going to use that and to transport these 42 men with their weapons and everything up the Mekong River, Basak River, excuse me, over to the Mekong and on up to near where the ambush site was. And I hadn't gotten any word yet from my friend in Fort Bragg. So I asked the agent. He refused to even talk to me about it. He wanted to know what hour and what day we're coming and how we're coming back from Cambodia. And I wouldn't have told them that anyway, because they'd have somebody then on this side of the border to ambush us. So I just canceled the operation, and I kicked him out of my camp, and I had my exo take him right to his little white whirly bird. They used white helicopters over there, the CIA did. And on the way out of the camp, on the way to that helicopter, he turned around, looked at me, and he says, "Captain, you can't go against the company because you can't win," or words to that effect. The exact quote is in my book. Within 6 or 7 days, the CIA had sent an entire regiment of over 1,000 men to kill me and my men. And it was a Lieutenant General Quang Van Dang who got in his helicopter, got in a helicopter with his Colonel William Desabri, which was his senior U.S. aide, and they flew over that regiment, and they called down to the Americans that were with that regiment as advisors and asked them, "Why are you going to attack An Phu," which was my camp name? And he called back up to Colonel Desabri and said, "Because there's a renegade captain named Marvin who's leading the Wahaos against the central government." Well, that was a big lie. It's because we wouldn't go and kill Sihanouk. So General Dang told Premier Key that he was taking over the situation, and he ordered that regiment back to their camp. And he came into our camp personally and gave us complete immunity from any action from the Vietnamese government. He didn't have control of the CIA, of course. Then the CIA turned on General Dang, and I had to then rescue him 20 years later out of Canada, where he was operating under an assumed name and under the threat of assassination by the CIA.
Well, the CIA's got a long memory, and if you turn against them, they'll come after you and they'll kill you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is funded with your tax money. Not only that, but they're the largest purveyors of drugs anywhere in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody knows that, of course, except the American people. In fact, Monica Jensen Stevenson used to work for 60 Minutes, wrote a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and it went into the CIA and drugs, and they pulled that off the shelves of the bookstores here. I know personally because I went down to the bookstore, and the copy that was on the local bookshelf, it was gone. I asked what had happened. They said they'd pulled the book back in again. And then, of course, Monica eventually was able to get the copyright back, moved to Canada. We have actually an interview with her. It's called One Man Came Back. It's the story of Bobby Garwood, where she tells how when they republished the book in Canada, somebody bought up the publisher, and then accidentally, by chance, it was a terrible mistake, they shredded the 5,000 copies of a book that has been published.
Oh, my goodness.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is what happens in the real world. And you can hear my interviews with Monica in the first four tapes that we have. Let's see, The Men We Left Behind. And then the other four tapes set, One Man Returns. She tells the story of them accidentally shredding the books. We have these stories on tape. You can hear the people. And, of course, she actually tells the story about how her husband, William Stevenson, a very well-known author, had sort of ridiculed her because she kept saying the CIA was involved in drugs. And till one evening when a fellow from MI6 came over and visited him, and Stevenson had good contact with intelligence agencies, and he mentioned, you know, my crazy wife thinks the CIA is involved in drugs. And the fellow from MI6 looked shocked and said, well, didn't you know? Everybody in the world knows the CIA is involved in drug smuggling. And
just
at that point,
Barry and the boys, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, of course, William Stevenson helped his wife write the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and we still may have a few used copies we went out and bought so we could offer it for people. If you'd like to know about it, you can call our 800 number, 800-544-8927. The book is Kiss the Boys Goodbye, not only about the men we abandoned, but, of course, about the Central Intelligence Agency and drugs, the same people who tried to track down this Vietnamese general 20 years later. And was he ever able to get into the country safely?
Oh, yes. I found out exactly where he was in Canada, where he was under an assumed name working as a janitor and dishwasher. This is a man who was the second most powerful man in Vietnam until he rescued us, basically. And once I found him up there, then I started writing the Justice Department and the State Department, because a lady friend of mine had gone to Ottawa and looked at the records, and they had almost a file drawer full of allegations against General Dang from our government and with no proof on any of them. And so I wrote the Justice Department and the State Department and demanded an investigation across the board to clear General Dang of all these illegal accusations. They refused to do it. So I finally wrote a letter to President George Herbert Walker Bush. And in that letter, dated the 17th of June, I believe it was, in 1989, I told him that I would not give up in my struggle to free General Dang of all the illegal accusations from this nation until either I died or the Lord came and took me up. And I put inside that envelope with that letter a small, like 3x3 piece of pink paper, and I hand wrote on that, I am intimately familiar with your role in the CIA prior to your admitting it publicly. Let me tell you, Doctor, within 2 weeks, a complete investigation was made. General Dang was cleared 100%. I got an email with all this stuff was presented in court, by the way, at the trial, to include my letter to President Bush plus the document that I'd gotten from the State Department, which quoted my letter to President Bush and saying that he had been cleared of all the accusations, more or less, and that he'd been issued a permanent entry visa. I think it was the 16th day of September of 1989, and I went up to arrange to go up to bring Dang into this country, and I got a call from a friend of mine in the CIA, and he said they're going to have an ambush set up and kill you and Dang when you come across the border. So I immediately called a friend of mine in the state police, and he and three other volunteers were ready to set up a counter-ambush. And I called Congressman Matthew McHugh, and I told him what was going on. I said, Matt, there's going to be a lot of blood on the border unless you do something about it. Well, within an hour, Congressman Matthew McHugh called me back, and he said, Dan, I can promise you that the safest place in the world for General Dang will be coming across that border with you. So I took his word for it. And went up and got General Dang. Now, General Dang is the man that General Westmoreland himself accused of bringing millions of dollars out of Vietnam. He accused General Dang's wife of running a chain of houses of ill repute up and down the coast of Vietnam. And she is the sweetest lady you ever did meet. Everything that he owned did not fill the bottom, the floor, of a 14-foot U-Haul truck. This is the man that brought millions for himself out of Vietnam. Those were some of the false charges. As we came down towards the United States border, about 2 miles above the checkpoint, every vehicle had been pulled off the road. When we entered there, we were the only vehicle in there. There was no traffic from the United States or Canada. They didn't even look in the truck. All they did was get fingerprints from General Dang and cleared them, and we went to McDonald's restaurant and had his first U.S. meal. But that's the kind of thing that they'll do unless, I mean, I had the Lord with me or I would have been dead a long time ago.
I'm sure you would have, but the Lord is good. And
Amen.
Ladies and gentlemen, things like this is so hard for people to believe. This is like what you see in a movie, but this is the real world that Colonel Marvin lives in. And I've been on the periphery of similar things. There really are vicious and wicked people out there, and I believe that they've preserved Colonel Marvin. And fortunately, at least I hope that the Lord is preserving me for what I'm doing. I've
Amen.
Had a lot of my friends who've been killed or died under various mysterious circumstances. I've interviewed three, probably four assassins. One of them himself was assassinated. A number of people that I've interviewed have died under very mysterious circumstances. One of them, named Gary Webb, who wrote about the CIA and drugs, ended up shooting himself in the head 2 times.
Yeah.
To make sure he was dead.
That's a pretty neat way of suicide, isn't it?
Would you like to talk about how you were asked to kill this Lieutenant Colonel, what was his name, Pritchard?
Oh, that's
Lieutenant Commander
Bruce Pitzer.
Pitzer, okay. Would you like to tell our listeners about that, the time we have left? Here was a Lieutenant Commander, a naval officer, who, of course, had information about the Kennedy assassination. He had actually taken pictures there when the initial autopsy, not the one that was done to Bethesda, but before that. And they wanted to kill him, and they asked you to kill him, didn't they?
I got a call. I was the logistics officer for the 6th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg. And on the 5th day of August of 1965, I got a call from Colonel C.W. Patton, who was the commanding officer of the 6th Special Forces that I was assigned to. And I was called to meet him in his office, and I did. And what he did is said, there's a man from the company waiting to talk to you down in the Pines. So I walked down to the Pines. Colonel Patton, of course, had no idea what he wanted to talk to me about because he wouldn't be allowed to know. I got down there, and I was on orders already to go to Vietnam. And But we were trained that as assassins for the CIA, special forces were used overseas. The mafia people were used in this country, and I verified that with a don of the Boston Mafia when I personally met with him, Joe Hill and I did. But anyway, so I went down to the woods, and he said, would you volunteer to kill a man who's about to give state secrets to the enemy? And, well, why not? I mean, I was a Green Beret. I was trained. We don't want people giving secrets to the enemy. So I agreed to do it. Then I asked who it was and where was he, and it said U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitzer, and he's at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I put the brakes on it right then. I said, look, we're supposed to do things overseas. The mafia is supposed to do them here. Well, they were having some problems with the mafia at the time as far as who was controlling who. And anyway, I told him why. I said, look, I got a wife and three children. I can't just disappear, which would have happened, and then come back after I'd taken care of Pitzer. But what they wanted was, and I found this out later, when I, by the way, there was another Special Forces officer that came and waited about 40 feet away from where I was meeting with him. And when I left, after refusing the mission, he went up and met with him. I don't know whether he did it or not, but somebody killed William Bruce Pitzer in his office, made it look like a suicide. He was found dead beneath a ladder going up to his overhead, and I think that's where he stored the film and the slides from the remote control cameras that he ran to watch the Kennedy autopsy. Dennis David, who you know and who you've interviewed, stood right next to William Bruce Pitzer and saw those films of the autopsy, which proved beyond anybody's doubt, even an idiot could look at them, until that Kennedy was killed from the right front.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. All right, go right ahead.
I hope I'm not taking too long.
Oh, you're doing just fine. Go right ahead, Colonel.
But when I found out that William Bruce Pitzer...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
544-8927. We carry Colonel Marvin's book, The Expendable Elite. That's The Expendable Elite, the story not only of his experiences in Vietnam, being asked to actually kill the leader of a sovereign country, but then we also carry the book Without Smoking Gun, the story of the murder of Lieutenant Commander Spitzer. And, of course, he was killed. He was killed after Colonel Marvin had been asked to assassinate him. And then, of course, if you want to know about the story of the USS Liberty and the courageous men who survived the vicious attack, and the fact that the people in Washington, D.C. wanted them dead, and, of course, the story of the commanding officer, captain of the USS Saratoga that on two occasions launched flights of planes to go to the USS Liberty's rescue, and each time the planes were called back. And of course his naval career ended because he tried to protect those men. We have actually a 4-tape set on the USS Liberty. We have a syllabus on it, we have a DVD, we have a video, or you can get a Liberty Special. It's important. People need to know about that. We have, of course, the 4-tape set on the assassination of Martin Luther King, along with a book written by Mr. William Pepper, who actually was the lawyer in that case. And, of course, the book is called An Act of State. And it deals with the fact that the government had Martin Luther King killed. You must understand that we have an invisible government, and it works through the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations. They have a plan, and that is to destroy America. It's in the process now. They intend to destroy the value of our currency. That's what all these phony bailouts are. They have nothing to do with stimulating the economy. They have to do with destroying our currency. And they're talking about, well, we're going to have to come up with another $2 or $3 trillion. Where is it coming from? They're simply going to print it, destroy the value of our currency, impoverish our people, and then, of course, move us towards the one world government. And behind that are the powerful spiritual forces that energize these people. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. If you haven't heard my talk entitled Forbidden Secret and Get the Syllabus, you need to get it. You need to get our material on concentration camps. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, they are built, they're ready. We need to get our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus that goes with that, with all the documentation, and, of course, how they're monitoring everybody in this country today. And believe me, they have your name on the list as well. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to get the great new DVD we have, The Eye of the Phoenix, goes into the emblems on the back of the dollar bill, the occult emblems of the ancient mystery religions on the back of the dollar bill, put there by a president who was involved in Satanism. His name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he's the one who began packing the Supreme Court with Masons so that they could take God and prayer out of our schools. And it was the Supreme Court justices that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was the 32nd degree Mason, and Harry Truman, who was a 33rd degree Mason, placed on the Supreme Court that, of course, a decade or two later, actually, of course, took God, two decades later, took God and prayer out of our schools. Understand that once you understand how it all fits together, it makes a great deal of sense. because they hate Christianity and everything we stand for. The Eye of the Phoenix must see. You also need to see The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, an excellent, very professional DVD, actually won all sorts of awards. And then the next in the series of Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. Of course, a DVD we produced entitled The Atlantis Connection, and then The Emergence. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now writing blogs and writing books and of course, keeping us abreast of what's really going on in our country and the world today. Because if you have listened to our programs for any period of time, you realize that the major media in the United States is controlled, that the people who control Time Magazine and U.S. News and World Report and Newsweek all come from the Trilateral Commission, that there's a small clique that controls the major media outlets here and makes mockery of the concept of freedom of the press. And that's why many people listen to Radio Liberty on a regular basis, because they want to hear the truth. William, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thank you so much for having me on as a guest. It's always a blessing.
Tell me what we're going to talk about tonight.
Well, what we're going to talk about is what we try to talk about every week, which is the bracing and inevitable reality of the collapse of the American empire, which was built on debt and fraud. And that's happening in real time right now. And it's happening in ways that really would defy the rational expectation of anybody who's in any way in touch with our founding documents. It's long been said that the Constitution poses no threat to our current system of government. The thing that I find really remarkable is the extent to which the will of the people plays no role in our supposedly representative system of government, our supposedly representative republic, or actually mass democracy, which is what we have. What we have is a ruling oligarchy sustained by a mass democracy that is presiding over a vast empire that is part of a world which is ruled by a larger or a smaller but more influential oligarchy. And the thing that I find most remarkable about the so-called stimulus package, and it's interesting, we talk about the way that the media is controlled by the power elite and the way that the media deliberately shades and manipulates public impression so as to prevent people from truly understanding what's going on. This is a perfect example of how quickly the media takes its cues from the people who control it, and the extent to which people will find themselves being herded by the manipulation of language. We are now told that this is a stimulus package. Everybody is told to debate the stimulus package. Everybody is asked their opinion of whether the stimulus package will, quote-unquote, work. The thing is, we're not talking about a stimulus package. We're talking about plain, old-fashioned, albeit a hyperthyroid variety of the old public works, welfare state, pork barrel spending that has been going on for the better part of a century or longer.
I know, I think the most amazing thing about this spending bill, apparently the after it had gone through the House committee, House and Senate committee, it was 1,200 pages. It wasn't released until midnight last night.
Exactly.
And then, of course, they asked them to debate it immediately on the floor so they could get it through today. Ordinarily, they go home on Friday, but they were held over to actually to vote on this, and nobody had read it. I mean,
yeah,
there's no way anybody can read this bill, and everybody knew they hadn't. This has nothing to do with representative government.
Exactly.
This is government being opposed from the top down. A 1,200-page bill, and of course, most of this, if it stimulates any jobs at all, most of them are going to be in China. In fact, because when the we don't even know whether they've kept a stipulation in that they had in both the House and Senate bills that the steel and other things that were going to be used in the major construction products were supposed to come from the United States. But the elite doesn't want that. They want globalism. They want to send our jobs overseas. They want to send our wealth overseas. And, of course, that's why they're horrified that anybody would suggest that we buy American. Oh, my goodness. That would defeat globalism. Well, you go right ahead.
Well, all what you're describing, Dr. Stan, is entirely correct. And the deception begins with the very nomenclature which is being used here. When they refer to it as a stimulus package, embedded in that title is a big question. We're to assume that this will stimulate the economy, when, of course, government spending does nothing of the sort. Government spending can give the economy the equivalent of a sugar rush, if anybody's familiar with how that feels. It's not a very healthy sensation. You blow up very quickly, you burn out very quickly, you have a sugar fall, a sugar low, a crash that is just as big as the rush, or even worse. That's how a depression occurs. Excuse me, I'm still trying to fight through the remnants of a cold here. The way that the cycle occurs in the boom and bust economy is that you have a huge quote-unquote stimulus being provided by government spending, and usually, almost always, through inflated currency and credit provided by a central bank. That's the sugar high. The depression or the recession, the crash, the correction, the contraction, however you want to describe the bust, is the sugar crash, which is always very unhealthy. Enough of this goes on long enough and you destroy the economy, the health of the economy, just as you destroy the health of a body if you go through so many cycles of the sugar rush and the sugar crash. What's going on right now is that they're having us believe by virtue of the term that was chosen that only the government, there's something Mr. Obama, who's a Marxist down to his chromosomes, simply assumes is the case. Only the government can stimulate economic growth, which means that if they're correct about this, we shouldn't have private enterprise or private industry at all. It all should be run by the government because economic growth and prosperity all begins with government action, according to this theory. The truth is exactly the opposite. All government spending is purely consumption by nature, pure consumption. It adds nothing to the aggregate wealth of an economy. It develops nothing of any lasting good. Anything that actually adds to the net worth and net wealth of a society is a product of private exertion, private enterprise, private construction. The only way that you get out of an economic contraction is to allow the malinvestment to be flushed out of the system. That's a painful process. It's painful both for both creditors and for debtors. It has to be. And then after this is wrung from the system, you eventually start to save and produce again. That's the only way that you get out of a depression. As it has been said by Bill Bonner, who's one of the best and most astute observers of the international economy, the cure for a depression is a depression. It's the fever that burns the infection out of the economy. What they're trying to do right now is to administer palliatives in the hope that we can somehow avoid the pain of the fever, but while they're doing it, they're giving us a larger dose of the same sickness that is going to kill the economy.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Grigg, and we're talking about the fact that they're doing everything wrong to remedy the economy. What we need to do is let these faulty banks go down, let them collapse. You know, they're the ones who brought this whole thing on. Don't stick the taxpayers with these massive debts. Don't create all this new money, which can serve no useful purpose, but it can destroy the value of our currency and rob every citizen in America of their pension fund, certainly of their retirement, anything they have invested in bonds or in insurance or annuities. This will all be destroyed by inflation, and they're doing everything they can to promote inflation. So why don't they just let these banks that created the problem go down? Oh, they say they're too big to fall. Ladies and gentlemen, if they don't fall, then America will fall, because they will destroy the value of our currency. And the real purpose of everything here is to impoverish our people and bring about a one-world government. And that's why, of course, they hate the idea of Buy America. They don't want to promote American jobs. They want to promote jobs in China and in Brazil and in Mexico and in Russia and in India and every other country in the world. But that's why they hate the idea of Buy American. Go right ahead.
Yeah, they hate the idea of Buy American. More appropriately, though, or more to the point, they hate the idea of Produce American as well. They've strip-mined the industrial economy. They've destroyed our productive capacity to produce the type of goods that we could market so as to bring about the growth that would cure the economic contraction. Last time, and Gerald Celente, one of the more astute observers of the trends here, a very capable and very knowledgeable man who's been studying these trends in the economy and society now for the better part of three decades, actually. And he was predicted a number of the economic downturns very, very much in advance, very perspicuous observer. John Celente points out that back in the 1930s, last time we had this type of a contraction, we didn't have a huge debt overhang, either publicly or privately, comparable to the one we had right now. You didn't have credit card usage. As a matter of fact, most people had never heard of such a thing as a credit card. That was something that was invented, the concept of it was invented by the Bellamy Brothers, not the Country Rock Act. The Bellamy Brothers were the founders of the nationalist movement back in the late 19th century. Edward Bellamy was the one who wrote that manifesto disguised as a science fiction novel called Looking Backward, and his brother was the one who composed the original version of the Pledge of Allegiance, which was very much a socialist document when it was first produced, and it went through some revisions to make it a little more acceptable to conventional Americans. But they predicted the advent of credit cards way back in the 19th century as a way of bringing about a cashless society attendant to a socialist system. But when we had the downturn of the late 1920s, early 1930s, people didn't have mortgages, they didn't have credit cards, and more importantly, we had an industrial economy. We were producing things, we were exporting things.
And we had a gold-backed currency, so they couldn't just print all the money that they want to. Now they can print trillions of dollars. They have tripled the monetary base of this country in the last 3 or 4 months. And, of course, this is a recipe for inflation and disaster, and they know exactly what they're doing. They're not stupid.
Yeah. They're not stupid.
They know. But do you know a better way to destroy a nation than to destroy the value of its currency? And that's exactly what Ben Bernanke, Helicopter Ben, and that's exactly what Mr. Geithner, certainly member of the Trilateral Commission, Bilderberger's Council on Foreign Relations, Group of 30, one of the most subversive people we've ever had in government, and of course he is the Secretary of the Treasury, and, you know, they ask him what he's going to do, and he won't tell anybody what he's going to do, but I've got a plan, just trust me. I would not trust him any further than I could, throw a 100-pound shot. Go right ahead.
Well, Mr. Geithner, of course, you're somebody who was brought up through the ranks, and at every juncture he was an apprentice to one of the worst exemplars of this power elite that we're talking about. He worked at Kissinger Associates. He was an apprentice to Larry Summers. He was an apprentice to Robert Rubin. He's somebody who spent most of the last two and a half decades, still a very young man, he's only 47, I believe, spent the last 2.5 decades learning the ins and outs of the dark arts through which power and influence are transmuted into wealth on the part of this immensely corrupt ruling elite that we're talking about. He knows nothing apart from the exercise of force and fraud to enrich this ruling elite through the banking system. And so he's somebody who's perfectly suited, having been, of course, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York City and being one of the chief architects of the policies that led us into this disaster. He's perfectly suited to ensure that the people on the lifeboats are going to be the ones who created the disaster rather than the victims the same. Excuse me. And so it's an interesting phenomenon. You talk about how the people who are ruling us are not stupid. There are many contemptible things, but they're not stupid. They can understand certain rudimentary principles. They can understand what happens to an economy when you inflate the currency, when you triple the monetary base of an economy within a number of months. They know the consequences. And they know what happens when you heedlessly spend and when you don't produce anything. They know the consequences in terms of the impact it will have on the nominal middle class in this country. They know that they are leading us into hellotry, into peonage. They know that they're leading us into something more abject than feudal serfdom. That must be what they intend, because otherwise it makes no sense that people that intelligent would be pursuing policies the immediate and predictable outcome of which would be the complete pauperization of what remains of the middle class. It just stands to reason that that is the intended objective. That's the intended result. And now, of course, with Mr. Obama presiding over this mess, you've got somebody who's, once again, very much in the social Marxist tradition, who's been sold to the public as something completely different from Mr. Bush. Now, granted, Mr. Obama does speak in complete sentences. That much is something of a relief to those who have to listen to him. He has a certain superficial charisma. He seems like a pleasant enough fellow, despite the fact that, once again, he's somebody who's a complete product of a Marxist milieu. But he has continued seamlessly from his predecessor to the point where he has kept the entire national security team of Mr. Bush's administration and then brought about a Clintonite restoration in just about every other element of the executive branch, beginning with putting Hillary Clinton at the top of the State Department. And with the economic team he's got right now, with the likes of Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner, you've got pretty much a seamless continuity, once again, with the architects of the disaster that's now unfolding.
Oh, don't forget Paul Volcker of
yes.
Permanent World, and six of them come from the small group of members of the Triological Commission, only 87 of them, six of them of Paul Volcker's group of 30 come from the Triological Commission, and the chief advisor to the President of the United States, Mr. Obama, is Paul Volcker. Don't
yes.
forget him.
No, of course not. It was Mr. Volcker who said in 1979, 30 years ago, for those who are keeping track, he said that the standard of living of the typical American is going to have to decline. He said 30 years ago. And he wasn't just saying that with respect to the economic decline that was underway right at that time. The 1979 through 1983 recession was a very steep and very deep one. He wasn't talking about that. He was talking about the long-term objective of the cohort that he represents. Mr. Volcker, I should point out, is also, of course, the guy with the push broom. Every time the United Nations gets into some trouble, he played a role in the limited qualified hangout of the details regarding, I believe, the oil for food scandal at the United Nations. He was one of these people who made sure that a certain number of people were exposed, but the people who were at the top of the pyramid were protected. That's one of the things that Mr. Volcker does very well. You remember Mr. Nixon back in the 1970s talked about the PR strategy of the qualified limited hangout. We'll expose certain things to the public. We'll own up to certain venial sins, but we'll try to conceal the more important ones. Well, that's more or less the type of thing that Mr. Volcker has been doing for the ruling elite for most of his life. And the fact that he is where he is in the Obama administration tells us a great deal about the way that public perceptions are going to be manipulated, because they're anticipating that we're going to see pretty much a full-blown, fully-orbed crisis and collapse of the system, or else Volcker wouldn't be there. The other thing that I want to point out here, with respect to this huge bill that was dropped on the Congress, you're talking here, once again, as you pointed out, about a bill that was made available midnight, just hours before the vote. They had 11 hours to review a thousand-page or multi-thousand-page document.
1,200-page
document. Containing the better part of $1 trillion worth of spending. Much of this was not even in the hands of the staffers in either house of Congress. From what I understand, what Ron Paul said is that there were maybe 20 people who knew what was in the bill. There were four hard copies available of the bill. It obviously wasn't posted on the Internet. And a lot of it was still in the handwritten form. They were patching together this bill, and they dropped it on the Congress so as to have the Congress rubber stamp it. Really, when you take a look at the role of the Congress here, and this is something that Mr. Obama has done that represents continuity with Bush once again, as he has turned the Congress of the United States into a rubber stamp body akin to the legislative assembly under Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
You know, I think if we have to really be able to visualize, because I think it's hard for people to visualize what's going on. Well, we basically have two governments. We have the government we see, that's the visible government, and we have congressmen, we have senators, we have Nancy Pelosi, we have Harry Reid, and they get up and they give speeches, and they have votes, and they argue back and forth, and it's all showbiz, because, of course, they really do not run the government. They pass laws, but of course they ignore the laws. They counter them with presidential directives or executive orders. We have an invisible government, and they're the ones who pull the strings. They're the ones who control all the key positions, and they act, they do what they want to, irrespective of the laws of our land. So until people understand we have an invisible government and a visible government, so much of this really doesn't make any sense.
That's exactly right. What we're seeing basically is a play staged for our distraction and amusement that has no substantive effect on the outcome of public policy.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with William as we explore these what's going on today. And you are seeing the demise of our country. You're seeing the destruction of our economic system. And believe me, of course, the bailout is just the first in a series of bailouts that are going to be designed to destroy the value of our currency. And, of course, they can't let the American people know that this is happening intentionally. Why, they might be angry to realize they're going to lose their freedom. Go right ahead.
When we talk about the way that the legislative process is being rigged here, it's important, once again, to hearken back to what happened last September with the creation of the TARP. And most people focus on the bill and the bailout element of what was going on without paying attention to the mechanism that was being created. The reason why Timothy Geithner, once again, former head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, an understudy to Henry Kissinger, an apprentice to the likes of Larry Summers, Robert Rubin, the reason why he can hold a press conference on Tuesday and say, I don't know what I'm going to do, but you simply have to trust me to do the right thing, is because he has been given plenary authority by the measure that was passed in that fitful, panicked orgy of dishonesty in September, where you had the Congress of the United States create an economic dictatorship in the office of the Treasury Secretary. There is no oversight. There is no accountability. Basically, the Secretary of the Treasury, working in collusion with the head of the Federal Reserve, those officials are in charge of the economy right now. What's been going on with the so-called stimulus bill, and I want to get back and talk a little bit later about how dishonest it is to call this a stimulus bill once again, that basically is a palliative, as I said, is a sideshow. The real business of what's going on in the economy goes through the Department of the Treasury, through the Treasury Secretary working with the Chairman of the Federal Reserve, because the amounts that are being discussed right now, and granted we're talking about the better part of $1 trillion, they are really quite negligible when you compare that with the amount of money that is being generated and the number of liabilities that are being assumed through this axis of the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve. That's where the real action is going on. That's where the ruin is being wrought on the economy. What's going on right now with the so-called stimulus bill is an illusion. That is really a distraction. It's misdirection. And it's an outrageous thing. Granted, spending $800 billion to enrich the same constituencies, the same constellation of welfare state constituencies that have been in the Democrat Party's orbit for 70 years is outrageous. And it's going to have an impact in terms of domestic politics. But that's all this is about. It's about domestic politics, to give people something to argue about, while the people who really run the economy, the people who are behind the figureheads at the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, are setting up the entire economy for a definitive fatal collapse, and setting up the mechanisms that will be in place for this new global economy that they're going to create, this new Bretton Woods arrangement, this one-world banking system with a central bank and a centralized global fiat currency. That's where the real action is. We'll be discussing the minutiae, and some of the minutiae is really quite outrageous of the stimulus package, so-called, and we'll be debating whether or not it will stimulate the economy as if it could do such a thing, while the real action, once again, is going on in another part of the government altogether, and it's going on behind the scenes within the realms of the secret governments you referred to. Now, that having been said, it's just fascinating to me, living in a small community in the Treasure Valley of western Idaho and eastern Oregon, to see how people are debating the so-called stimulus package as if it were a really important thing. We have a small circulation newspaper in Ontario, Oregon, called the Argus Observer. For several days this week, it's been going out and asking men on the street, the proverbial man or woman on the street, what they think of the so-called stimulus package. And they've been running a series of editorials talking about how people...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just saying that in the area where he lives there in Idaho, why, Chris, the local newspaper going out, asking the people on the street what they think about the stimulus bill. And, of course, as if somehow this really was a stimulus bill. Let me point out, I think it's a stimulus bill. It's going to stimulate inflation.
Yeah.
It's going to stimulate jobs in other countries if they have their way. But it is not designed to put people back to work. How is, of course, providing health care for children going to put people to work in our society? How is it bailing out the states, which have been spending too much money for a long period of time, is going to create, 3 or 4 million jobs right here in America? And it's all a lie. They have no intention of creating jobs here in America. They have no intention of solving the problem, because if they solve the problem, they would not be able to proceed with their program for the destruction of our economy and the fascist control of our people. But you go ahead. You were talking about how they're getting the man on the street opinions. What are the man on the street saying about the stimulus bill?
One of the essential elements of this process you're describing, Dr. Stan, is that people have to be convinced that they're the ones in charge, or at least they're making some kind of a substantive contribution to the public discussion. And this illusion of consent and control by the people is very, very important to this grand deception. And so you have this town of about 14,000 people, Ontario, Oregon. I live in a town of about 7,000 called Payette, Idaho. We're across the Snake River from each other. We get the same newspaper out of Ontario. The man or woman on the street is being asked about the so-called stimulus package, and you have all these editorials. Many of them are rip-and-read reprints from other newspapers, but some of them are generated in this little newspaper office here in Ontario, where they're recapitulating all the catchphrases and all the buzzwords and pretending like they're actually having a serious discussion. One of the things they're saying, by way of insistent repetition, is that people have to take part in this process. We have to do what we can to make sure that we get our share of the stimulus package money. We have to be putting together lists of projects of the local government, the municipal government in Ontario, the municipal government here in Payette, the state governments in Idaho and Oregon, put together their wish list of things that they want the federal government to fund on the assumption that this is what we have to do to make the economy work. We have to try something. Doing nothing is simply not an option. And so we all have to be part of this process. This is how the whole machine works, is that they give people the illusion of informed consent and the illusion that they're somehow in control. And to resurrect one of my favorite similes, it's a little like the little toy steering wheel that sometimes you put in the child seat to give the toddler the illusion that he or she is actually driving the car. But while this is all going on, the real business is taking place completely off the radar scope with Mr. Geithner, the people behind him, Mr. Bernanke, and the people with whom he communes. They're the ones who are really making the policy right now. Now, for those who are interested to find out what's actually going on in this bill, there's a very good website. You've probably given it out already, stimuluswatch.org. They're sort of a clearinghouse for information about what is in this monstrosity of a bill, stimuluswatch.org, the number of projects that are being funded. One of the things that I found as I looked at the wish list that was submitted by various groups was that some of the major projects being funded here are simply block grants to enhance and accelerate the militarization of law enforcement. The U.S. Conference of Mayors put together a wish list of pork projects that included, I think, more than 24 requests for money through the Byrne Grant Program in the Justice Department. The Byrne Memorial Grant Program consists of block grants given to state governments, which are filtered into police agencies, usually municipal police agencies and sheriff's departments, to create multi-jurisdictional task forces under the rubric of the war on drugs, but actually what they are doing, to put it bluntly, is they're conducting theft through asset forfeiture. They develop whole communities of informants to give them tips so they can carry out these full-force, no-knock raids. Sometimes they'll find narcotics activity. Often they don't, but whether or not they find it, if they can find something that they can connect to drug trafficking or that they suspect was the product of drug trafficking, such as personal property or funds, cash, assets, that sort of can be seized through civil asset forfeiture. That is one of the major ways that a lot of these municipalities and police departments have been funding themselves. In Texas, for instance, the seizure of property from motorists through certain interstate corridors is one of the major sources of revenue. The Burn Grant program is seed money for this activity. That's part of your stimulus package at work.
Well, I think we're in real trouble. Of course, the thing is that the last we want is a militarized police force that is answerable to the federal government. My fear is that we're moving rapidly towards a fascist America. There really are concentration camps out there, detention camps, that many of them are built, others are being built. There really are plans to round the American citizens up and put them in concentration camps, and if you doubt that, you need to get something we call the Amazing Clips or the Shocker, or get a concentration camp special, and you'll actually see these congressmen talking about the plan, in case of a national emergency, to round up Americans and put them in concentration camps. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Will Griggs, our guest. Go right ahead, Will.
One of the things that we've talked about, and you mentioned just before the break, of course, is the fact that there are plans and provisions for creating detention centers, supposedly in several instances, to deal with the prospect of large-scale ingress of illegal immigrants from Mexico or elsewhere. But I keep hearkening back to the fact that in the late 1990s, the Halliburton Company received an no-bid contract from the Clinton administration to build detention centers in Cuba, supposedly to house Haitian refugees in the event that you had a huge outflow of Haitians during the conflict over restoring Aristide to power. And that center ended up, that detention center ended up being the Camp X-Ray, which was the beginning of the Gitmo facility down there, which has been used as a detention center for so-called unlawful combatants, and was become one of the more notorious black sites for torture and other abuse of people who have no legal rights. I do think that we cannot possibly overestimate the cynicism and the depravity of the people who are running the government right now, and the fact that they are putting money into the system for the purpose of protecting the reigning oligarchy and those elements of the governmental system that will protect the interests of the oligarchy right now. There's a remarkable news story that was put in circulation just this morning, that describes an interview an Indiana County municipal official had with people from FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security over several years, and what he said is the following. I hope I have time to read the entire quote. If I don't, I'll come back and finish it at the other end of the break. He was told the following things in the course of several interviews with these FEMA and Homeland Security officials. We want to know every important thing in this county. We want to know where police departments are, where weapons are stored, hazardous material, where we can land a helicopter, where are the airports, how big a plane you can land at the airport, where are all the bridges, where are all the power stations, where are all the generating stations? Where are all the substations? They literally wanted to know where everything was. I'm sitting here thinking, man, if there ever was martial law, this kind of information is exactly the kind of stuff they're going to want. We're just laying it all out for them right there. He was also told that they wanted to know, of course, where all the weapons were. They talked about hardening police and fire stations, putting in hardened bunker type of buildings around the town. This, of course, was in Indiana, within a short driving distance of Chicago. The county was asked to make plans for the possibility of up to 400,000 refugees from Chicago.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Christopher Will is giving us a list of something to request from the female people in a community. I believe it's in Indiana. But before we go on, Will, I would like you to go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get your material, how you can get your blog, how they can get your book.
I appreciate that.
And we're looking forward to getting those books.
Yeah, I know. I've been a little bit busy. I can invoke, I suppose, the fact that we just had a new little one a week and a half ago. It was my most recent excuse for my tardiness in getting that supply of books to you, Dr. Stan. My website, which is, once again, sort of a shell website for everything I do, is willgrigg.com. Very easy to remember, willgrigg.com. For those who go to willgrigg.com, I would suggest that they look at the upper right-hand corner of the page for the external links, and the top link is to my blog, Pro Libertate, which I try to update between 3 and 5 times a week with a brand new essay, usually 1,200 to 2,000 words in length. I'm trying to make them more reader-friendly in length, between, say, 700 and 1,000 words, but so far I'm not having much success, because when I start writing about a subject, I want to keep peeling away layers until I can find something that I consider to be really the really important plate tectonics of a subject, or to use a different metaphor, the major muscular structure of a subject, so as to give people an idea of what they can anticipate.
Oh, don't feel bad. Whenever I write my newsletter, my wife, of course, goes over it to correct it, and it's always too long, and so
yeah.
I get into the same problem. Go right ahead.
I have a real difficult time with managing my appetite for exposition, but Pro Libertate, as I say, I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week as my schedule permits. And if you go to the Pro Libertate blog, at the bottom of every essay there's a link which will take you to Amazon.com to buy a copy of my new book, my most recent book. It's about a year old, called Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And that book is a little more than 300 pages long. I'm told by people who have read it that it's really brisk reading. 300 pages seems like a daunting length, but what I'm told is that it really goes by pretty quickly, because unfortunately, things that are terrifying are often very interesting and very easy to read. We're talking about a terrifying subject. We're talking about the consolidation in this country of a militarized, centralized law enforcement apparatus, the purpose of which is not to protect our persons and property, but rather to protect our ruling elites from us. And that's something which has always happened in every tyrannical system since we have record of such systems, since political systems. You go back to the age of Nimrod, you can see where every ruling elite has tried to fortify its position that way. We're no exception, unfortunately. But we were supposed to have built-in safeguards that would prevent the consolidation of such powers, the chief of which, of course, is the fact that law enforcement, under the Constitution, was supposed to be a purely civilian matter that would be a local affair. The states were left with plenary jurisdiction and authority under the Constitution to take care of law enforcement. The federal government, the central government, that is to say, was to have no role beyond those specific crimes outlined in the Constitution that are federal offenses. That's something that James Madison was very emphatic about. And the Founding Fathers, when they forbid the creation of a standing army through the mechanisms that make the army dependent on biennial appropriations by Congress. They didn't want to make it possible to have a standing army. They were worried primarily about the prospect of a standing army becoming the sinews of a tyrannical occupation regime in the name of law enforcement, because they had lived under that type of regime during the later part of the colonial experience. Well, what we have right now is a situation where the military is becoming more overtly a presence in the daily law enforcement affairs of this country. And more importantly, the more dramatic development is the militarization of local police, not only in terms of the demeanor and the accoutrements that are more and more military issue, but also the disbursement of high-tech weaponry from the Pentagon, the cross-training of police, not just the tactical and SWAT teams, but typical ordinary police with paramilitary and military outfits, the special forces outfits, Navy SEALs and such like, the provision even of hardware such as tanks and armored personnel carriers and other and other assets of that sort to the local law enforcement in the name of fighting narcotics, but also in the name of crisis management, counterterrorism. That's something which is going on through the LESO, the Law Enforcement Support Organization, through the Pentagon. Every law enforcement organization that receives support from the Pentagon is considered to be part of the Pentagon structure. It's now considered to be part of the military. And any law enforcement office, or any law enforcement agency, rather, that receives so much as a dollar of federal support through the Homeland Security Department is considered part of the federal government's law enforcement apparatus. That's something the Bush administration made clear in a legal dispute arising out of a lawsuit in California just a few years ago. And so all this is covered in my book in some detail, and I go into detail out of necessity. So as first of all, to be credible, but secondly, to give people an idea of how we got here, because we're going to have to backtrack and back to the point that we have something akin to the system that existed a number of decades ago, before this process began. A lot of this, of course, was triggered by September, well, not triggered, a lot of this was inflicted upon us in the name of reacting to September 11.
But it was planned long before.
It was planned long before that.
And we have an article, it appeared actually, in a Florida newspaper written in 1966 by Richard Haass, the current president of the Council on Foreign Relations, member of the Trilateral Commission. And in 1966, Richard Haass was talking about how, you know, when the terrorist attacks came, and it was not if, but when they came, were there going to be long lines at the airports? It would be very, very difficult to get into federal buildings, long lines to get into federal buildings. They had all of this all worked out ahead of time. We have the article. Anybody wants to see it? It's important that the American people understand that they know exactly what they're doing. They just want the American people to know that what happened on September 11th was the range of long-range planning to justify the imposition of a tyrannical regime on America in the name of course, protecting us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's living in a cave and taking dialysis over there in Pakistan, if you really believe it. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, it was 1996, wasn't it?
1996, I'm sorry, what did I say?
1966.
1996, you're absolutely right.
I think Richard Haass is only about 48 or 49 years old. 1966 was a policymaker. But yeah, I very much remember that article where Richard Haass, at the time, I think he was, what, a senior fellow in the CFR?
Something like that.
Yeah, but I think it was written originally for the Washington Post Wire Service, and what he was saying is that there was going to have to be a trade-off, that we were going to have to surrender freedoms in exchange for security. And I think the precipitating event there was the still-unsolved Olympic Park bombing in Atlanta during the 1996 Summer Games in Atlanta. And wasn't Richard Jewell, the security guard who was set up by the FBI to take the blame for that? And what I was saying at the time was that the bombing at the Olympic Village there was almost certainly one of these little episodes of black propaganda where the atmosphere is being tuned for certain things. You had that bombing that was in the very conspicuous centerpiece of a global event, and then you have the people like Mr. Haass and others in his train of public mind molders talk about the need to undertake this equation. We're going to make some trade-offs in individual autonomy, some trade-offs in the guarantees of personal liberty in exchange for security, and that starts the process where people are being programmed to accept these things. But as you point out, Dr. Stan, and you've been, I think, peerless in documenting this, these things were planned a long, long time ago in terms of the consolidation of the military with the police. These are operational programs and blueprints that have been on the drawing table now for many, many decades, and these things are enacted opportunistically. They're not something which is done by way of responding to events that catch the ruling elites by surprise. Where necessary, they will create the pretext, but they will certainly capitalize. When something happens that they didn't necessarily plan for, they'll call an audible, to use the football expression, and they will opportunistically exploit any available pretext for enhancing their control over us. And this so-called stimulus package, once again, is such a perfect example of that, because there are so many little Easter eggs, to use the modern computer or gaming expression, when you have a DVD with little hidden programs in it that you can find with little nuggets of insider or hidden special features. It's called an Easter egg. Well, this so-called stimulus bill has so many Easter eggs in it, it could probably fill off an entire wing of heart patients with the cholesterol. You've got, for instance, the National Coordinator of Health Information Technology. What is that? Well, it's somebody who'd be in charge of rationing health care. Somebody would be in charge of cutting off health care if, by the calculations of the government, which already spends, which already runs more than half of all the medical facilities in this country in terms of regulation and subsidy, the government already controls half of the healthcare economy, they'd be able to use this National Coordinator of Health Information Technology in his office to determine on the basis of Hillary Care-style metrics what kind of healthcare people will receive. But probably, I've not been able to get the details of it, but I would assume that they'll be using metrics such as the so-called QALY, Q-A-L-Y index, Quality Adjusted Life Years. What's that? Well, that's a formula that would be used to dictate whether you have sufficient expectation of a quality of life to justify receiving certain kinds of treatment. We already use that kind of triage when we're talking about, for instance, the VA hospitals, when they're dealing with people who are aging World War II vets or Korean vets. If they get to a certain age, it's just not seen as cost-effective to give them a certain type of health care. If they're in their 60s or 70s, they just don't have the expectation of a sufficient number of quality-adjusted life years to justify the cost.
Well, I think what you're really talking about, Will, is rationing of health care.
Yes.
In the name of, oh, we're here from the government. We look at all these people are not getting health care. We've got to do something. 40 million people without insurance. And then what we're going to do is ration health care to everybody. And that's what it's about, ladies and gentlemen. It's about control. It's about fascist control over health care. May God forgive us.
Exactly. And it was interesting how Speaker Pelosi... very early on when they were putting this monstrosity together in whatever Frankensteinian facility they did this, she was talking about the idea of making enhanced spending for birth control, all these antinatalist undertakings. They're not just talking about birth control, they're talking about the distribution of abortifacients. They're also talking about roundabout subsidies for outright abortion and infanticide. She's talking about this as being part of the stimulus package, and people asked, how is that going to stimulate job growth? She said, well, no, that won't stimulate job growth, but that will have economic consequences in terms of reducing the material demand on the economy. She was approaching it the way that any communist would approach the proposition. She starts from the premise of scarcity. When the government operates an economy, it's always in a position of distributing goods on the assumption of scarcity, because the government can't produce anything. And so you have these restrictions placed on the economy that end up with rationing being the distribution mechanism, and so you end up with too few resources to meet the available demand. So what do? You have to start reducing the number of people.
Well, I think the other thing you have to understand is there will always be a two-tiered medical service. There will be one for the elite, members of Congress like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, and the president and the retiring government officials. And then there will be the medical care for the common people like you and me. And I would simply point out, I'll never forget being in Edinburgh, Scotland, and talking to the professor of orthopedics there, and I was asking him about delivery of health care, and he said, well, we have two systems. We have the emergency health care, and then we have the elective health care. He said, we never get around to the elective health care for the average individual, unless, of course, you are a commissar. That was his word, not mine. Unless you are a commissar, and then we're forced to take you in and operate on you immediately. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do not believe we have a two-tiered system as far as pensions and health care right now, if you are retired from the U.S. government, congressman, you're going to get a much better pension than Social Security. They would not have Social Security for the congressman. They have special health care insurance for congressmen after they retire. But it's far better than anything you get. And if you think that they're going to ration health care to the elite, it's only for the common people. Where is the outcry? And, of course, it's frightening in its silence.
Well, what's going to happen is that people are going to be forced awake. They're going to be startled awake at the same time. And that's what's going to create a huge outcry. That's why Gerald Valenti, I adverted to him a couple of segments ago, this the trends analyst from New York City, one of the more astute and capable analysts of social trends, he He says there's literally going to be revolution in this country. He expects it's going to start this year. By revolution, of course, he's talking about widespread uprisings. He's talking about taxpayer revolts already in the eastern, in New England just a few days ago. There was a march on the homes of a number of people who were connected to Citibank, some of the CEOs and major corporate offices of Citibank in one of the towns in New England, can't remember which one, was surrounded by a group of people who were flown in by a left-wing group, which is, of course, preaching exactly the opposite of what should be done by way of solution, but they ring the homes of these CEOs and held a mass protest that was called a pitchfork moment. Now, of course, this is done largely by way of political street theater, and the people who are promoting this, of course, are the sort of people who believe that the ultimate object of revolution would be government control of the entire system, as opposed to a revolution that would be to restore individual liberty through law.
And did anybody ever ask, where does the money come from? It costs a lot of money to get a demonstration like that going.
Exactly.
It costs a lot of money to fly people in. And believe me, this money is being put up by the very establishment that they want a controlled opposition.
Yep.
Because, of course, they want, of course, justify ever more government control in the name of controlling the wicked people in Citigroup or the wicked people in the Goldman Sachs or the wicked people in J.P. Morgan Chase. And let me tell you that they're the ones who are, in all probability, either putting up the money or related to the people who are putting up the money. They're all, every one of those three banks has membership among this 87 people. Americans in the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. Isn't that a coincidence? Who's funding the demonstration against the members of the Trilateral Commission? Why, I suspect it's the Trilateral Commission. Go right ahead.
They run both sides of the game. They play both sides of the table, and so they're always going to win. You know, I mean, if you play chess against yourself, how can you lose? And there are people who are more than willing to be pawns, and, of course, the pawns are the first to be sacrificed. And so one of the things that we have to do is get people to stop thinking of themselves as pawns and think more strategically. They have to understand how the game board has been rigged against them. They have to understand how they're being deceived into acting in certain ways. And they have to address these issues in ways that have to do with the reality of the situation as opposed to the manufactured pseudo-reality of the people who are actually running things. That's one of the reasons why you and I do what we do. We're trying to help people know what's really going on and who's really responsible and to give them some path back from the precipice that we're standing on right now.
And that's why I love to have you on every Friday evening to keep us abreast of the things that are going on. I guess it's been Will Grigg. Will, quickly, get out your blog site.
WillGrigg.com. Go to WillGrigg.com and in the upper right-hand corner, it'll take you right to my blog, Pro Libertate.
Okay, fine. WillGrigg.com. Go there, get his material, it's excellent. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, will you go right ahead? I get so involved with our conversation, I forgot to, almost forgot to get your website out. Forgive me.
I appreciate that. One of the things that I would emphasize here is that we are still in a point where it is relatively easy and relatively inexpensive to prepare materially for a lot of what we're going to be dealing with now. People need to be able to commit to a program of austerity, and I used the word triage earlier. There's a good kind of triage. They have to go through and prioritize their needs. We have to be willing to do without certain things. For instance, I had a conversation this week with my family about cable television. I said, I just can't justify spending money on cable television. Why are we going to be buying cable television? There's a lot of good stuff that we can have through cable television. There's a lot of garbage that we'll get through cable television by way of the same type of deception that you and I have been describing, Dr. Stan. But it's just money that we'll be throwing after something that really doesn't add to our home environment or our material ability to deal with the times we're living in right now. We need to be willing to forego a lot of those luxuries and instead think in terms of what we need to survive. We need food, we need water, we need shelter, we need clothing. We need the community of good friends and family and people in the fellowship of the faith who see things the way that we do. We need real money in order to deal with the ravages of hyperinflation, which are probably going to hit around the end of March or maybe a little later than that. That means gold and silver. We need to have ready cash on hand because the banking system is insolvent. That's something that the New York Times admitted today. The banks in this country are insolvent. Fractional reserve banks are insolvent by definition. You need to have real money. You need to have some cash on hand because that will be valuable for a while anyway. and you need to be prepared to minimize your profile to those who would take what you have. That would be not only common street criminals, but it would also be the criminals in positions of political power. You need to be fortified against the time when everything that we consider to be important in an economy, a false economy of luxury, is taken from us. And that means that we need to get in touch with the things that are most important, our families, our communities of like-minded people in the faith, and, of course, our relationship with God. And if John Zalani once again said, those who followed the authorities' instructions on 9/11, went back to their offices, went down with the towers, do not believe anything that the people who are ruling us are telling us. Nothing that they say is true. Everything that they say is meant to deceive us or is an outright falsehood. That's the most important thing that people can learn from what we are reviewing this evening. Don't believe what they're telling you. They do not have your best interest at mind, your best interest at heart.
I agree with you totally. Thank you so very much for being with us. I'm glad your wife is doing well. Talk to her this afternoon. God
Wonderful.
Bless. Talk to you next week.
Thank you. God bless.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoy our Friday evening programs with William. I always do. Certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen we have, certainly in the conservative movement. What a privilege it is to share his views with you. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out 5 hours every weekday, and then on a weekend program. We have about over 60 outlets every single week. It's an expensive proposition. So far, while we've been able to continue doing what we're doing, we've lost some people, but other people have been more generous in their giving. And if you are in a position to help us, believe me, communicating with people is the most important thing today. We must reach the people and educate them about the spiritual battle in which we're involved today. So if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it. If you'd like to distribute it, we give you a much reduced cost. If you get a number of them, you can get our DVD. You can actually copy the DVD with our blessing. And any of the other items, our 4-tape sets or our DVDs, as long as you're not making a profit on them, get them out far and wide. And never give them to people, lend them, and get them back again. You need to get our talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus, on the planned police state and the syllabus. You need to get our 4-tape set on concentration camps, or the DVD, or the concentration camp special. You need to get this information to others. They really are planning on a dictatorship in America. You, of course, need to get the new DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix. You will never look at the dollar bill again, realizing, of course, the occult symbology there. That was put on by the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who began to pack the court with Masons to take God and prayer out of our schools, to destroy the moral fabric of our society. And he and Harry Truman knew exactly what they were doing, but they didn't want the American people to know. And then, of course, we have the other DVDs in the series, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, the Riddles in Stone. You need to get our DVD on They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or the 10-hour version. They sold their souls for rock and roll because many of the people in the music industry actually have made a bargain with the devil. This is not imaginary. The devil is not an imaginary force. There really are supernatural forces out there. And if you doubt it, you get into the other items and then ask for a copy of the Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. It's published by the Luciferians. The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are Luciferian organizations out there, and some of them are financed by the most wealthy and powerful people in the world today. Why are they financing them? Because that's where they get their power. That's where they get their wealth. They've made a bargain, and of course they're living up to their part of the bargain and helping to finance these movements. Understand that these movements extend into the highest levels of our government. They are intent today upon destroying our economy. If you've not yet seen my little pamphlet on the history of money and then the financial meltdown, We have a three pamphlet set, the occult hierarchy, going into the background of the people who really rule the world. Certainly you want to go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And certainly get my November and December newsletters. Pull them down. Copy them. Give them to people. Sometimes when you tell people too much, it's hard for them to believe it. But if they see it written down, they can read it through a couple of times. You'll raise questions in their mind. And then encourage them to go to our website at radioliberty.com. RadioLiberty.com and listen to our programs. And they can listen, certainly, to live programs 4 hours a day, to the satellite feed 9 hours a day, listening to Radio Liberty. But we need to get people listening. And then, of course, we hope you'll want to get the DVD sets of Pastor Billy Crone, The Final Countdown. Part one and part two, each with five DVDs. Understand that this is a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty.